right. Hi, everybody. It's RCFB Talk 188. My name's Bhavik Khairy. I'm going to be your host tonight. This is Tuesday nights when we always talk about what's going on in college football. So I'm firing this up right now. Hit on the tweet so that you all know how to join in. Just hit request if you'd like to join the conversation. We try to make this a conversational show where if you want to talk, just hit request. We'll let you up here. Lots of things to talk about in college sports. I'm just going to begin by just touching on what happened in basketball, only because the ratings were stunning. I mean, the men's game did well. It was a bit of an uptick. You know, they had almost 15 million people watching UConn's victory over Purdue, but I think this is the first year ever where the women's final beat the men's. And thanks Caitlin Clark, you could argue, almost certainly because of her, that their loss to South Carolina pulled 18.87 million. That's incredible. Those are numbers you just don't see in sports very often. So it's one of those moments where, I mean, we'll see how many fans hold over to next college basketball season for the women and how much of that will follow her to the WNBA. But good for them, good for the sport, and it's just a stunning number. I mean, I have to be clear, like, if you actually look up and if you've paid attention to the numbers that are coming here, that was the most watched basketball game in at least college basketball game since 2019, and has beat almost every ESPN broadcast involving women's sports. I think in terms of women's sports, it was actually interesting. I was looking at some of the numbers being thrown around there. I think the last time anything beat that, I mean, the king of all, and I'm old enough to remember Nancy Kerrigan versus Tonya Harding in that Olympic. That was the biggest women's sport ever watched. And the numbers for that were just saying 18 million is incredible. They drew 78 million for that. But that was a different ball game. If you've seen I, Tonya, at the very least, you know what that was all about. So maybe if the college basketball players start sending, you know, crazy boyfriends to club the other team members, they'll see even more. But that's that. We'll jump off basketball right now. I just thought I'd mention that because that number was incredible. You know, actually tying in as a fun transition from college basketball to college football, it is true. Caitlin Clark in this past season in 39 games scored a little over like 1,200 points, which beat the Iowa football team for the entire time she was there. From 2020 to 2023, across 49 games, the Iowa football team scored 1,028 points. She scored over 200 points more in the 2023-2024 season. So that kind of puts a lot of perspective together. But I think that's a good transition as we move back to our college football conversation. You know, a couple of other quick news and notes. It's been reported from several sources, and I'm just looking at a tweet from Nicole Arbuck from The Athletic, but I've heard it confirmed by guys like Ross Dellinger and other good reporters in that area. The NCAA's Division I Council is going to basically push through new legislation to more or less codify officially what was forced upon them in a court ruling, the ones that have basically lifted all transfer rules or transfer limitations for college athletes. I believe, though, they're going to still try to hook it on to some academic requirements, some specific academic requirements. But essentially, there's going to be no limit on the number of times an athlete can transfer with some academic connection to it. This is a response because as soon as the court put out a court order, and this is in the middle of litigation, where they said there's an injunction preventing the NCAA from enforcing transfer rules, the NCAA immediately basically said Charlie Baker, to his credit, I mean, comparing him to past NCAA presidents, and maybe it's because it comes from a strong political background, having been the governor of Massachusetts, he just basically said, look, he probably got the powers that be, aka the university presidents who are his bosses. And he said, like, look, we can't possibly win this court battle. It's time to get ahead of this one. So they conceded pretty quick. And this, I guess it's an emergency legislation meeting to change the NCAA transfer rules later this month is to basically officially say that, okay, we're going to go ahead and go with what the courts are putting on us for that legislation. Another potential change is they're trying to give colleges a more hands-on role in NIL deals. From what I understand, they're trying to blend this with colleges can help athletes, because previously they couldn't. They weren't allowed. There had to be that kind of distance between NIL collectives and the universities in terms of making deals, which obviously was probably being violated left and right, which is part of the problem of the system when they kind of were thrown into it because no one had had a chance to plan for it because the NCAA and the universities were being dumb about the idea of compensating athletes. But this new kind of legislation would then allow colleges to be part of the NIL deals, at least helping arrange them. And the trade-off is it would require college athletes to also actually say the numbers that they're getting, because one of the things the NCAA, one of the things Charlie Baker is still trying to get done is to have basically a database, a public database, or at the very least to universities and to athletes to see what NIL deal numbers actually look like so that players can supposedly see what deals are out there, not kind of work in the dark. You could argue both ways in the sense that maybe it'll cause an increase in some NIL deals for athletes who maybe realize they're being underpaid, or it might work in the other direction and kind of lower the amounts that are spent on athletes. We'll see how that would play out in practice. Also on the topic of NIL, and this was a couple of days ago, a good friend of the program, Daniel Libet, who I've talked to several times, Sportico reporter, business reporter at Sportico. And I'm going to just say, he maybe went a little further with it than I would have, but the IRS finally denied nonprofit status of an NIL collective. And I'm going to say the reason I'm not going to go so far as he did, he's like, oh, it's an indictment of the entire system, because some of you may remember, and I don't blame you if you don't, but in January, or at least a couple of months ago, a little earlier than that, last May, IRS's Deputy General Counsel mentioned in a memorandum that they were questioning whether these NIL organizations met the obligations to be a nonprofit, because many of them are organized as 501c3s. I'm a little familiar with those because our CFB, the organization that I'm part of, we have our CFB, which is a federally recognized 501c3. And informing that, I worked with a law firm because I'm a lawyer by background and I'm smart enough to know when I need a lawyer. The issue is, you have to make sure whatever you do ties into a charitable purpose. Some of these NIL collectives are run fairly sloppy and may run afoul of being a nonprofit. And that, of course, means they would have to pay taxes if they don't fall into that 501c3 exempt status. The thing is, last May, that memorandum came out, which called into question whether NIL collectives would meet that. Since then, several NIL collectives, perhaps more, have been cleared as 501c3. So that means even though there was this kind of warning, it wasn't actually happening in practice. But finally, I guess, and this letter that came out was actually, even though it was reported in April, came out last January with the IRS actually denying at least one NIL, nonprofit or at least tax exempt status, because it was not fulfilling the requirements of being a 501c3. I am curious to see how far this goes. Do we see more NILs kind of go in that direction? Do they lose their 501c3 status and then taxes are a factor for them to pay? And how does that affect the donors that are throwing money into them? It'll be interesting to see that. But I do think with some of the more sophisticated NILs, you're going to have men and women who know how to check the boxes that will please the IRS. So that's why I'm a little skeptical, or at least a little hesitant to say that this is going to be doom and gloom for all NILs, at the very least for their nonprofit status. So that was a really dry thing, I guess, to kind of go through, but I just wanted to get that one out there. On a lighter note, let me just, and then again, I'm going to get to Ski Mask Smurfy because I see him up here, but one kind of on a lighter note, Deion Sanders, because that's always a fun topic to talk about, right? Apparently, there were some professors complaining to the coach about their, some professors complaining that some of his players were making class difficult and they were feeling disrespected by athletes. So what Deion did is he got the team together, read the complaints, called out specific players that were mentioned by professors, and then pointed out that they don't have draft grades. His point was being that all players on the team are not going pro, and if they are here getting paid and a free education, they need to be taking advantage of the latter. So I thought that was a pretty bold move. I think a lot of folks who follow college sports actually probably would be happy with some people. I think who absolutely dislike Deion Sanders would absolutely love that kind of story. I don't know. That sort of fits into that. But let's get to anyone who wants to call in. Let's start off with Ski Mask Smurfy. What's going on?
Oh, hey, Bobak. How you doing this week, man?
I'm good. It's fun. Off season, just there's stuff to talk about. Yeah, I was always surprised. Every time I think it's been kind of a quiet week, I kind of look at the news and topics of interest, and there's always a little stuff to talk about. It's always amazing.
Yeah, I was going to talk about the women's basketball, but you we're so far past that you went on a roll. But you were on the topic of NIL, and I want to sort of stay on the topic of money. And that someone posted in the Reddit yesterday, the subreddit, that there are 25 schools that have an operating athletics budget over $150 million. Mm-hmm. I don't know, that's something we've talked about before on here. When you said, you know, we're trying to turn the student athletes into employees. And you always want to like, yeah, some of these schools are running these massive programs. I just think it's interesting that some of these schools have gotten to the point where it's over $150 million, which is like, yeah, 25 schools. And I mean, the list is the usual suspects, of course, near the top, which surprisingly, number one being Ohio State, beating out both Texas A&M and Texas. But it also made me think, you know, as you said, if we turn the students into employees, that may create a whole nother problem, because we know how, I mean, you can estimate how much football and basketball costs, but to run the rest of these without money coming in, that could be a major problem moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. You know, I think the teams aren't going to have, and by the way, it's so funny for those who haven't looked at this kind of gathering of information, and I'm not 100% sure of how accurate this is, but it looks right, like it passes the eye test. But Ohio State, Texas A&M, and Texas are fairly close together, and they're all in they have budgets over $250 million range. So they're at the top. And I mean, you know, the bottom of this list is Washington, which is 152.6, which is still a tremendous amount of money. But yeah, these are all the numbers. The teams just wouldn't surprise anyone. I mean, I'll just go through the 25 because it's 25, you know, just looking at top 25. It's like Ohio State, Texas A&M, Texas, Michigan, Georgia, Nebraska, Penn State, Tennessee, LSU, Alabama, Oklahoma, Wisconsin, Clemson, Auburn, Florida, USC, Kentucky, Notre Dame, Florida State, Iowa, Arkansas, Stanford, South Carolina, Oregon, and Washington. I mean, nothing too shocking. Stanford is kind of a funny one because they are like USC. I'm surprised UCLA wasn't in there now that I'm looking at this. But because USC, Stanford, UCLA, Texas, they're schools that compete, and Ohio State to some extent, not quite those in the sense that they compete in like every sport humanly possible, it seems like. So I'm not shocked to see some of those up there. But I'm actually surprised I got USC's numbers only because, and it would be like getting Notre Dame's numbers, they're a private university. But it's interesting to see. And I think these are the programs that are going to have no problems, I think, paying athletes to some extent or another, despite their complaints. This is a slightly different analogy here, but it reminds me of when the NCAA decided to boost the dollar amount required to pay to apply to move between FCS and FBS. They moved it from like something comical. It was like $5,000 to $5 million or something like that. I mean, it's just a huge jump. But it was interesting to read analysis because some people actually went and interviewed, some good reporters went and interviewed like ADs at some of these schools that were on the border or schools that had just moved up. And I said, like, would this have made a difference? And they're like, no, not at all. It would have been absolutely worth the $5 million. And if they're going to move, they're going to pay it. It's not a big deal because they're already going to have to pay a lot of other money. So I wonder if, especially for these top 25 schools, or at the very least, the very top schools, maybe the top, I don't know, I don't want to say 80, like the Super League, which I think is nonsense, but you know, that's been proposed out there. But there are going to be programs that are willing to spend that. And just to go back to what you kind of mentioned, yeah, I think the students, and I mean, this isn't even, I think they should be, or I don't think they should be. This isn't going in even my personal like thoughts on this. Just the reality, the analysis of what's happening, both on a legal level and the complete lack of action on any legislative federal level, means that we're going to end up with the students, the student athletes in all sports. But, I mean, at the very least football, but I don't see any reason not to expect all sports declared athletes in some manner or other in the next couple of years. And again, just to kind of review for those who may not have been around a couple of weeks ago, or I should say a couple of months ago, there were a few hearings, for example, in the United States Congress. One was at the House level, and then a very glamorous roundtable held by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. It had to be a roundtable because technically he was not the party, or he was not the chair of the committee, so he could only hold like a talking session. But it was really just a, you know, they brought in Nick Saban, they brought in all these famous people. Then it was mostly a photo op. Like famously, Ted Cruz sat at the table with Nick Saban rather than at the desk, so it could be a good photo opportunity. But even him, the person who called the meeting, said, "Yeah, there's a 50-50 chance of this ever happening," and that is a charitable view. And he's the one saying it. That's the best possible view. But in reality, it's a little annoying with the election year obviously coming up. Congress isn't going to tackle this. They were already unlikely to tackle it a year ago, and it's just becoming less and less. And the reason that's important is without Congress stepping in and basically carving out a very special law that gives exceptions to the NCAA, and or at the very least college sports, because I don't want to erase the NAIA, there is almost certainly going to be either a court decision or perhaps a national NLRB ruling that is going to create some level of employee status for college athletes. Whether or not it is, again, and either of those, and potentially, who knows, there could be another. The other case out there that's going to really cause havoc is that NCAA versus House case. I just want to put that in everyone's mind. It's still going on. It's the one that is basically the back pay case. That's the best way to remember it. If you hear somebody talking about a case involving the NCAA that could be doomsday, it's called the House case. And the best summary is it's athletes asking for a period of back pay before NIL was officially in play. And that's the one that could potentially, I wouldn't say necessarily bankrupt teams, but will certainly be a huge thing that might disrupt the NCAA. And that is where, just to put a little more context in all of this, where the concepts that are being thrown out there of the Super League that got reported by The Athletic, I don't know if it'll work. I don't think that one will go all the way through, but that's when we may see this sudden, like, okay, well, let's rebuild from scratch because that case financially destroyed the present model, or at the very least, the folks that were running it. But my goodness, that was a wide-ranging answer. But when you brought up all the money that's being spent, I mean, it's hard not to talk about those particular topics alongside them.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting. I saw that person post that. I was like, it's interesting because like a few weeks ago, I wasn't able to bring it up on here, but like one of the local sort of smaller newspapers in the area here where I live in Virginia, they ran an article based on a Sportico post, which basically showed that James Madison, the one that just moved up to FBS, they get over $50 million of their department budget. $50 million of it comes from student fees, which made them number one, which I was a little surprised by. Mm-hmm. But then also in the article, they explained that a lot of the conferences basically limit how much you can. And surprisingly, I found if your conference isn't limited, for each state has a law on it. And apparently in Virginia, our state limit is like around 70% of the total funding you use for sports can come from student fees. And so James Madison, ODU, and Charlotte being the top three and all having just moved up, I found that to be interesting as well, too.
Yeah. You know, and I have to say, JMU's always had an interesting approach to this because they had Jeff Bourne, who was there for 25 years as their AD, and he's I believe he's retiring at the end of this spring. I think he's still there, but he announced his retirement last September. But he has been the whole reason why they were able to jump up the way they have, where they've been able to jump up and be competitive as a Sun Belt program. But I do imagine, yeah, these fees certainly were part of it because they were able to build basically everything that they needed to hit the ground running. And that's why I wasn't quite as shocked by the number, because I was always wondering, like, how did they fund all of this? Because the first time I ever saw like them mentioned it, when they were an FCS team, oh gosh, probably 10 years ago, I was just struck at how big the stadium was. I'm like, they have a double decker. I mean, not completely double decker, but there was like a section where they had like an upper deck. And I'm like, that is unreal for, I didn't know this FCS team in Virginia was this popular, but it was all about their kind of incremental approach to climbing up it. When I saw that, and I saw that article as well, that it suddenly made me realize, oh, okay, that's how they've been kind of funding all of this. I wonder how much the students had a vote in it. Sometimes they do. Sometimes students happily vote to put fees on themselves, but I'm not sure what happened there. You know, let's see, we have someone else up here who wants to join the conversation. Jeff, what's going on? Thanks for your patience.
Hey, yeah, no problem. Duck fan here. I keep hearing about the Super League, and I was just wondering what your take on it is if you think it's actually something that's going to come to fruition, or if this is just something, you know, people are talking about. I personally don't like the way it sounds, but just wondering what your take is on it.
Yeah. So for those who weren't around to see this kind of news break, so about, almost 6 days ago, it was Wednesday. It was the day after we did this show. And I was actually, when I heard it, I'm like, man, do I need to do an emergency show on this? But I kind of held back a little bit when I read it. So Andrew Marchand, who was a huge sports business writer who was hired by The Athletic, and Stuart Mandel. This is like, I think, Andrew Marchand's first really big kind of story in sports business for his time at The Athletic. But they basically started interviewing this organization. It's such a dumb name. I mean, not the Super League. The Super League is awkward only because soccer fans, especially European soccer fans, have a whole level of hesitancy around that name. But it's called like College Sports Tomorrow, which I live in Central Time, so they love to abbreviate it CST. So again, that you know, it's kind of sloppy, but whatever. So it's co-run by someone who used to work with Roger Goodell at the NFL and some top sports executives, but they want to create this league where there's going to be, I mean, the one thing, it's almost like they're bringing in a bunch of ideas that have been bandied about and trying to at least create some organization with it. So the idea of, you know, there'd be like 80 teams, basically 70 of which would be there all the time, you know, mostly the P5 programs that we're used to, divided into kind of new, probably geographically sensible divisions, and then kind of almost have like a mini NFL. But the kind of the interesting part that they kind of were trying to also throw in ideas was there was going to be a group of teams that were subject to relegation, whereas they would be the teams that would be left out of this however many teams, 70 or 80 teams Super League, would still be competing to get into that particular division and battle their way in. So that would be an interesting kind of quirk. So yeah, pardon me, 70 teams. So it'd be 7-10 team divisions. Oh, no, 80 teams, pardon me. So 80 teams, so 7-10 team divisions with those power five teams that are kind of left, an eighth division of teams that would be promoted from the second tier, and then there would be some movement. That was the concept. The problem is when you read the whole article, it's clear that they haven't really convinced anyone of importance, aka the Big Ten or the SEC, and there's a lot of money on the table that might be left. You're literally asking some programs to kind of put some money aside for the sake of the whole, for the greater good, and perhaps maybe come out with more money at the end. I'm not sure how that would fly. You know, it was interesting. I know the On Three, one of their national reporters, Pete Nakos, he kind of talked to some people he was in contact with, and an SEC head coach had told him that his athletic director, his unnamed SEC head coach, that they thought it was a tough road. They thought it was a dead on arrival kind of situation, to which, you know, Stuart Mandel defensively tweeted out that, you know, we said it had no traction so far with the SEC and Big Ten. So the story itself is interesting. It's been a talking point. And I do want to clarify, listening to it discussed by some other, you know, sports conversation, you know, podcasts and different people who I respect in the industry, I think the sense is that at the very least, while it may not be this version, if there is something that blows up the NCAA, like that House case where, you know, suddenly the NCAA owes billions of dollars in back pay and something like that, and they have to basically reform as a new organization, perhaps people will look to some of the ideas of this if it isn't necessarily these people. But at this very same time, it could go nowhere. You know, the system could keep working, and we may move forward as it is now because, you know, greed is a solid motivator for people, and all of these teams and these conferences want to keep it as much as they can to what benefits them. So it could be that, for example, if the NCAA blows up, we just end up with the Big Ten and SEC kind of rebuilding it in something that benefits themselves with some allowances for the other teams. I'm not saying I would like to see that, but I'm just saying that's another alternative where this Super League simply doesn't happen. But it's an interesting idea. It certainly brought up talking points. And the one thing is, at least it's an example of what would happen if you tried to create like some sort of central authority, which is something that college football has certainly lacked. Like the classic saying, like, wouldn't it be nice if college football had a commissioner, like Nick Saban, for example? But at the same time, you know, that's unlikely. And but it's interesting that, so I think it's been an interesting conversation point, and the way it was kind of delivered, and certainly the gravitas of the reporters reporting it. But the more you kind of scratch at it, the less likely it seems possible, at the very least, unless, I mean, crazier things have happened, you know, I mean, but I'm a little hesitant at this point. But it's, thank you for bringing it up so much. Oh, sorry, I was going to let up Mage Ingrid. I'm going to let up Mage Ingrid, too, to join in the conversation. Again, if you'd like to join, please feel free to hit request. If you'd like to talk, you can always raise your hand as well. I'll try to get to everybody. People are welcome to stay up and then to talk about whatever. You know, one other NCAA topic that Charlie Baker is trying to do, and I don't think this one is as, again, I think he's being smart as the NCAA president, because again, he's kind of arrived with a sense of how politics works, being his background as a former governor. He's trying to get rid of prop betting in college sports. That one, I have to say, we've talked about a little bit last week, made some sense. I think that one is not going to be an unpopular one, because the concern isn't necessarily, well, there's two concerns to it. One of the concerns is, apparently by reports, some of the cleanup players on various basketball teams, maybe even football, but I've heard more in basketball, are getting, you know, harassed on social media because gamblers who were betting the under or whatever are getting upset at them for not playing well enough to beat the spread or whatever. But the idea of playing on how many points player is going to score, that could be problematic. Obviously, we had an NBA player on the Raptors who has allegedly been caught, or at the very least has been put under scrutiny for potentially gambling on himself. And granted, he wasn't like a superstar getting millions of dollars, getting like a very good amount of money, but like $400,000, $500,000 a year. But if they're able to be lured by that, with thousands of potential NCAA athletes, who many of whom may not even be getting huge NIL deals, let alone going pro, you might find some people who would be willing to play ball, so to speak. And certainly there was that Temple UAB basketball game that got some attention this past season. So that's something where I kind of, you know, good, that one, I don't know if it'll move forward, but I know it has gotten some traction, I believe, in Louisiana, where they're trying to get some programs kind of, or some states to stop the idea of prop bets on players. But Ski Master Murphy, I see your hand up. What's up?
Oh, I was just making a quick comment on the whole prop betting thing. I saw the same article too. I've seen pro professional athletes, particularly in basketball, because I guess it's easy to bet props, that pro athletes are having the same problem as well with DMs of death threats. And I just wanted to point out, Jontay Porter, the NBA player you were talking about, he bet on himself, but he bet to hit in all his unders. For people who don't bet, you can bet to make more or less than a number. He placed a $10,000 bet to not make all his numbers, and he checked out of the game after 4 minutes, saying that he had that his eye was hurting, and they only found out basically the prop to hit all of his bets, all of his unders, was like the most profitable thing, and he bet $10,000 and literally made his whole season salary. So yeah, college person needs to take it out. And I mean, we have a 30 for 30 with the guy from Goodfellas basically saying, yeah, no one would have knew if he didn't bring it up nonchalantly in court. So I think they're moving in the right direction with this one.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, sorry, Mage Ingrid, you're up. I'd love to, I thank you for your patience. What's on your mind?
Oh, hello. Did you see the Final Four for both the men's and the women's this weekend?
You know, I didn't get a chance to watch all of it, but I did see the numbers. In the very beginning, I was talking about how especially the women's basketball final managed to beat, first of all, beat the men's basketball final, which I don't believe has ever happened before. But it's beaten, I think it was it was the most watched basketball game, college, pro, men's or women's, since the 2019 men's basketball championship, which only had a slight edge over it. And it was the second most watched women's sporting event outside of the Olympics, behind only the 2015 World Cup final between the U.S. and Japan, which had, that one really had a huge audience, 26.7 million between Fox and Telemundo. But it actually beat the women's, because I remember 1999 Women's World Cup, where, you know, that was the one where, you know, where famously, you know, the final game, you know, who was the player? Oh my gosh.
Chastain.
Yeah. Jessica Chastain, you know, taking off her shirt, you know, just celebration, that iconic shot, you know, so it beat that. I did not realize that. So that drew only under 18 million viewers. And I remember at that moment, that was like, it seemed like everyone was watching that game. But again, the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan saga pulled 78.7 million viewers, I guess, to see if one of them was going to club the other in the middle of the ice skating. But, you know, women's ice skating, man, that was a big deal. But all that said, while I think it's probably a Caitlin Clark thing that brought most of those viewers.
Yeah, I think that's it, which is kind of sad.
I hope it brings, I think, though, it'll be really interesting next year just to see the viewing averages. Because I think if you get that moment where so many people were paying attention to the sport, and the games were good, and they were interesting, you're going to get people who are more likely, I think, to casually watch and kind of maybe include it in their... in their diet. Of course, hey, let's be honest. I mean, men's basketball has been popular forever, but no one, arguably the season's less and less watched. I mean, the NCAA tournament does fall into that nice sweet spot after things have calmed down and all of the football and, you know, other sports are kind of, you know, no one's really on fire like the NCAA tournament. But I think this is wonderful. I think it's a great moment. It's absolutely fantastic. I never would have guessed we would have seen numbers like that. That it's astonishing. I mean, even in college football, that only I know, even before we got to this game, when we were just talking about that UConn Iowa game, which obviously only had 14.4 million, it still outdrew some of the most of the men's football, probably, you know, the college football games. I think only, and I don't know how this 18 million, how it ranks. I haven't had a chance to look, but the Ohio State Michigan game was the only regular season game that went past it. Yeah, and then the SEC title game, and then the CFP. The
college football playoff.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's incredible. That is absolutely incredible. I mean, I was almost like, Caitlin Clark should, everyone's talking about, what's his name, DJ over at NC State should try for the NFL. Well, why not have Caitlin Clark? Well, let's capitalize
it's
on
just
that.
Like, okay, like, the problem is, like, South Carolina still ain't getting talked about enough. I'm like, y'all won and y'all undefeated too. So I'm like, can y'all talk? Can the media like talk about them, please? Like, pretty please. It's getting annoying, honestly. Like, why aren't y'all talking about them?
Yeah, in South Carolina, especially. I mean, that you can't take away from that the fact that they won, and they won handily against Iowa in that final game. So, I think it's great. I think it's wonderful. And I hope it increases the interest in all of it. My problem is I'm also not the hugest basketball fan in general. So that's more of a, you know, agnostic statement about the entire thing, but
it's just racist fans, bro. Like y'all should have seen how it was on Twitter. Like, leave these LSU and South Carolina fans alone.
Yeah. I know LSU got a bit of that too. That was being unfortunately kind of featured a bit in that game as well. When really it should just be about watching athletes who are performing at a great level. But yeah, no, that it was great. I still can't believe it beat the men's final. That to me is incredible. That is a pivotal moment. Like that, I think it's so funny. You know, and maybe it's because of the time delay on how long it takes to get some of the reports. But I mean, that's gonna be one of those moments that's talked about just in sports, because most people like myself growing up, if you told me 20 years ago, I would not have believed you. Not at all. Like, wow, women's basketball beat men's in the final. Like that was just not something. And that's a sad thing. I think Rachel Bachman, the Wall Street Journal reporter, I saw her tweet out, and I assume it was an article either she was related to, or I know probably the journal put out there. But, you know, not only did they beat the men's, but the awkward thing is they got only 98 or 99. Probably they only got 1 or 2% of the TV money that the men's version did. So that is absolutely incredible when you think about it. So, but it'll be interesting. And a whole lot of stuff. I just one last basketball thought. With Calipari going to Arkansas, as a USC alum, I'm like, wait. So if USC had said to John Calipari, would you like to come to USC? Would he have said yes? I don't know. That was one to think of. I mean, but, you know, I'm a USC basketball fan, which means I know we have a team. But our women's team is apparently, I was actually like, why don't they just hire the women's coach to be the men's, the new men's coach of USC basketball? Because I don't see the problem. I mean, you can have men coaching women all the time and that there's no one bats an eye, but why not have a really great women's coach coach a men's team? I think that would be an interesting next move, in my opinion, but we'll see if that ever happens. Scoomass Murphy, your hands up.
No, I just wanted to say you brought up Calipari, and I see an Arkansas Razorbacks fan in there. We need to call them to the stage to get their opinion on that, because they think their university seems, no matter the sport, the coaching moves seem to happen at, they seem to be the most fun coaching moves. That is, none of it makes sense. Because you add in Bobby Petrino with Calipari making like a late night phone call to go to Arkansas. They're the best when it comes to coaching moves, because nothing makes sense and we're always entertained.
You know, one of the folks in our in the folks that run this Twitter account spotted a really, really funny tweet. I know we quote tweeted it from I guess his name is Jordan Poole, but it was Bud, which is, I assume, the arena is packed for Calipari's announcement. Bobby Petrino rides out on a Harley. There's a blonde on the back of it with a helmet on. For those who don't remember that his initial tenure as head coach of Arkansas, second tenure, I should say, ended embarrassingly when he got in a car crash on his motorcycle with a woman on the back. So that's the reference with this. The blonde takes off the helmet. It's Calipari in a wig. He takes it off and calls the Hogs. Chills in the audience. That one made me laugh. Anywho, if you've ever seen folks call the Hogs, it is absolutely a phenomenon. I have been in Arkansas Stadium to watch that. It is something else when you see 50 to 70,000 people, you know, doing woo pig suey. I'll tell you what. But yeah, if anyone wants to come up and talk about that, happy to have you come up here, Arkansas fans. You're always welcome. As well as anyone else who wants to talk about anything in college football here on RCFB Talk 188. You know, a couple of other things I'll just hit on and touch on really quick, because we had a couple of spring games that came up this past week. The two that kind of caught my eye were Auburn, mostly because it was interesting to see if they had any kind of offense, because clearly it didn't seem to work last season, where I believe no wide receiver crossed the 350-yard mark. But they also have one of the best wide receivers coming into the program, and that's the problem, because Jeremiah Smith at Ohio State has rightfully gotten everyone's attention, especially while he may not be all the way up to be, you know, obviously he's replacing some greatness over there, but he's going to probably be ready to play package, you know, number two, number three receiver, maybe make it to number one over the period of the season. But Cam Coleman at Auburn was the second highest ranked wide receiver. And by all accounts, what people saw in the stadium for the spring game, he delivered. It was interesting to say that, you know, he caught four or five passes, and the one he couldn't catch was one where he was reaching around behind the cornerback and nearly corralled the ball. I mean, he's one of those kids that just, you know, wide receiver is one of those positions where you can come in and play almost immediately, and physically, you know, you can compete. You don't necessarily have to develop through the strength and conditioning program to be quite as competitive as you might on the line or some of those other positions. So he looked amazing. He had a great deep touchdown pass. In fact, if anything, Hugh Freeze kind of said that they may have over-relied on him. The offense overall had to rely on quite a few field goals to win, supposedly. You know, don't want to read too much in this spring game, but at least the talent that was on display looked good. And again, just kind of going back to part of what Hugh Freeze said, they weren't quite as good in the red zone as they had hoped to be, because they were putting too many plays on Cam Coleman, who is an early enrollee. And here's the best part. After the spring game, he actually went to his high school prom because he you know, as an early enrollee, he was kind of missing that. So, you know, we'll see how that develops out. That's a promising move. You know, Peyton Thorne looks to be QB1. And when they were kind of talking, he gave a good impression of what he was kind of playing with here. He's like, look, with a good receiver, someone like a Cam Coleman and some of the other people who Auburn's lost previously, you know, a 50-50 ball becomes an 80-20 ball. So maybe the performance of these quarterbacks at Auburn will also go up. You know, there's another good wide receiver that kind of maybe gets lost in the shuffle here, and that's Robert Lewis. He was a star out of Georgia State who transferred into the program. And he also had a good spring game as well, catching some also other good solid passes. So we'll see where Auburn goes. I think especially after the kind of flat finish they had, or a flat season they had last season, other than obviously scaring the bejesus out of Alabama. This is kind of a nice move for them. You know, also one last bit of Auburn news. This came out just yesterday that, or I should say earlier today, pardon me, my times are off here, that Auburn is going to finally move away from Under Armour and become a Nike program in 2025. Much to the excitement of some of their fans, Under Armour has been slowly phasing out college sports over the last several years. This is probably one of the final ones that they are kind of getting out of. That has been sort of a program decision, or I should say a company decision, for a company that famously was all about college and very much attached to the Maryland program, because that was where some of their founders were connected to. The other spring game I wanted to just touch on was Clemson, because while the defense looked great, they're certainly able to reload, and I think we're going to see a strong one there. It was, again, kind of a wonky day for that offense. Cade Klubnik didn't look the greatest, neither did his backup, although the third quarterback, Trent Pearman, or Pearman, I'm not sure if it's Pearman or Pearman, he apparently impressed, but doesn't necessarily look great when the the best thing you could say about your offense is the third quarterback might actually be the second quarterback. I know it was kind of interesting. Dabo Swinney said, when asked about the performance of the team, he was a little disappointed. He said, our offense is incomplete. But I thought it would have been funnier if he said our offense is also intercepted for three times, in one case returned for 46 yards. So I'm not sure what to make of Clemson. It'll be very interesting to see what pops up in the spring transfer portal window. There have been a couple of interesting name drops already. Bear Alexander, who USC famously got from Georgia to then field an incredibly terrible defense thanks to Alex Grinch last season, he's announced that he's going back into the portal. So that might be another big move, and we'll see certainly some other players. In the next weekend, we're going to see Alabama play. We're going to see Ohio State play. Ohio State's going to have their spring game on Network Fox, which is unbelievable. But it'll be interesting to see how some of those games play out. It'll be interesting to see what quarterback emerges. I mean, we're expecting Will Howard for Ohio State. We're expecting to see some strength there, especially replacing Kyle McCord. But there's some great guys behind him. You know, Julian Sayin. Oh my gosh, Aaron Nolan. You've got some other guys already on that roster. So we're hoping to see that. It's going to be interesting to see how Jeremiah Smith performs, considering he's the number one receiver in the incoming class. Quinshon Judkins. Interesting to see how Ole Miss running back works at Ohio State, particularly how they're going to work him with Travion Henderson. It'll be really interesting to see how Chip Kelly kind of dials up that offense, or at least what he decides to show us. That's going to be one of those games to watch, especially since, you know, jokingly or semi-seriously, you know, Ohio State may have had a bad end of that season, but my goodness, did they turn things around in January to win the so-called January Heisman. So we'll see how that's playing out this weekend. And of course, Kalen DeBoer, we'll see how that Alabama offense starts to look. Apparently from the scrimmages that are being seen, Jalen Milroe and Ty Simpson's quarterbacks are looking good. But it'll be interesting to see how the rest of the program looks. Looks like we have an Arkansas guest who wants to talk about what's going on there. Elizabeth, what's going on? I transitioned too quickly there. Take it by surprise. Oh, Elizabeth, are you there? All right. well, we'll see if we get that.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, there you go.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I was muted. No, I was just saying, between the Bobby Petrino hire and now John Capp with, you know, our basketball program, I'm like, oh my gosh, I think we need to hire maybe South Carolina Don for assistant coach, because she's so amazing with that South Carolina win. But I think we have a unique combination this year. Who knows what's going to happen with the Razorbacks? It's unique, but I'm shocked about Kentucky. That I did not see that coming. We went from basically a zero roster to hiring Kentucky's coach. So again, still in shock, just me.
You know, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because my only concern is he going to reinvent himself, or at least recreate? because I don't know if his, what was happening at Kentucky was a sort of burnout in the sense that the model that worked for him previously wasn't working as well in this kind of transfer portal universe. So there were, that I think was, and just the fact that, of course, he'd had so much previous success that there was a bit of, you know, I remember when he and Stoops, you know, got into this Kentucky basketball school only, or can football have some room? You know, there was a bit of that kind right. of back and forth. So obviously Arkansas is as much a football school as anything, as any of the other SEC programs, at least it wants to be. So
well, right now we're a baseball school. Oh my gosh. Number one in the country. Hello. I'm like every single game I watch, I'm like, gosh, I'm not even so much a baseball fan, but every single week, I mean, I think David Van Horn just decided, you know what, this is the time. I've done this for so many years. I'm just going to stack the team and we're going to win. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah.
But you know, Cap is, I'm looking at his win percentage over his career in college, 813 wins, 260 losses, 0.78. That's a pretty darn good win.
Oh no, he's a basically Hall of Fame coach who's still coaching. I mean, no, he is actually, he's in the Hall of Fame. Pardon me. What am I saying?
He is absolutely.
He has earned the accolades. The problem is, the question is, can he modernize? Because again, Kentucky, you know, they made it to the Final Four last in the 2015 tournament. And it's been slightly diminishing returns since. And so the critique is, can he update himself? Can he kind of switch to what's needed in this particular, you know, college football universe, apparently college basketball universe? So at Arkansas, is he willing to kind of approach it differently? But at the same time, you know, if you've heard some of the conversations, you know, if he can produce, you know, reasonable returns like Sweet 16, Elite Eight runs that would have angered Kentucky fans, it probably would be good at, yeah. I mean, that was the thing that, you know, Musselman got Arkansas to two Elite Eight spots. You know, that was good enough for Arkansas for the most part. Although it sounds like he was starting to antagonize some folks,
he was. And again, you know what it is, Bobak, it goes back to the boosters. Same thing with Cap. I think the Kentucky boosters wanted, hey, we want national championships every year. Where at Arkansas, we're like, you get us to a Sweet 16, we're thrilled. And we have such a rabid fan base that we're going to appreciate that level of expertise and talent with him and value what he brings. So I think that new appreciation, I think that might be revitalizing him as a head coach. And also the John Tyson, you know, chicken money is not going to help, because that's a lot of money he's bringing in.
Yeah, people really love to talk about the chicken money. That's what I love all of this. My only concern, because I've heard some people, especially football kind of centric speakers, kind of bring up the Jimbo Fisher comparison, which I get. You know, Jimbo Fisher also you know, wins the national championship at Florida State and then kind of gets to Texas A&M and just kind of flounders. I, being a Minnesota Gopher by my graduate degree, I remember when Kentucky also coughed up a head coach that had won a national championship there and kind of slowly kind of not done as well season by season. And he went to the Gophers. So Tubby Smith,
I remember
that was a big coup. Yeah. In 2007, Kentucky head coach Tubby Smith just suddenly becomes Minnesota Gophers head coach. And you know what? He didn't last very long. I think the highlight of his career was he was the NIT runner-up in one season and lost a couple of first rounds in the NCAA tournament. Like, it just did not quite work. So, and I mean, where's he at now? He's at High Point. I think he's retired finally. But, I mean, he was out there for a while. So sometimes that's a concern. Like, are you getting the coach at their best? Or are you going to get, like, the downward trend? I'm not sure. Ski Mask Murphy, I see your hand up.
Yeah, I know we're supposed to be college football, but this is a fun topic. But all I got to say, Elizabeth, for the rest of you Arkansas fans, I guess the real question that your AD has to answer and John Calipari have to answer is, do you guys want to win titles, or do you guys want to have fun watching the Showtime Lakers? Because, I mean, even if you add in Memphis, John Calipari's record is basically, he gets all the one-and-done guys. Like, his record is just, if you average it out, including Memphis, he gets three guys who go to the NBA every year that he brings in. So he's just bringing in these
three guys.
Yeah, Yeah, wow. Like it's like it's basically every, if you average it off of all the seasons he's had is basically two first rounders and a second rounder in the NBA every season, basically. And okay. So basically, you know, he's bringing in these 18, 19-year-old kids who are great and going to go to the NBA, but it's like they don't know how to play as a team yet. And then he's got to redo that every year. Versus, do you want him to win championships? Which is this, like, excuse me, with the transfer portal, how it is now. If you want to win, you're going to get the older guys. You're going to get guys who are 24, 25. And so he's not going to be able to win. You're not going to win titles with 18-year-olds against 25-year-olds. But if you want the NBA guys, you're going to have a lot of fun watching
it. It sounds like you're making the case for BYU basketball, by the way. But
with the portal and with everything that's going on, you know, to get a couple of young guys, but get the experienced guys and that combination of those to win. And granted, sure, I want the guys to go to the NBA, but I think as an attraction to have an experienced coach that puts them in the NBA will get better quality recruiting, because he has the number two at Kentucky, the number two recruiting class in the nation.
Yeah, you guys will definitely bring in recruits. I think that's not going to be a problem. But I think, yeah, Ski Messmurphy mentioned it, as I kind of alluded to. The question is, can he kind of also balance that with that portal? And if he can, you know, there's no reason why it couldn't be unstoppable. I mean, that was a fascinating thing. I know you probably saw those charts of where, especially some of these Final Four teams on the men's side, where they all started their careers. And that was absolutely fascinating, where like almost all of them started somewhere else. There was some really Ski Mask. I know you wanted to add something.
Well, no, I wasn't adding anything to that. Breaking World College Basketball, and we did just talk about the women. So, like, breaking news as we've been talking. Stanford, Tara Vanderveer, the longtime Stanford women's basketball coach. She announced she's retiring. I didn't realize she was there for 38 seasons. That's
wild.
That's a long time. And then, she's in there. It's her. And the five, now including Don Saley, don't people with three championships or more. So that's going to be a dynamic change.
She's retired?
Yeah, she's retiring.
Wait, yeah, why?
Well, she's 70, number one, so maybe she's decided she's ready.
I think she's still going to go back for a few more years, though.
38 seasons. I mean, now's the time to sort of like going out at your best. She won the title in... that was 2021, right? Right after COVID.
Yeah.
She won that title. And then you have a generational talent in Cameron Brink leaving for the WNBA. So why not hang it up now? It's not getting better.
I think, yeah, exactly. I think, and maybe she's able to tolerate the NIL and the transfer portal, and maybe said, like, okay, all right, I've done enough. She had her saving moment. Like, okay, all right, I've proven myself enough. You know, like, I'm good.
She lead us past Coach K back this season, too. Like, dog.
Yeah, that was a very great season for them. But sometimes you just get old. And
break.
38 years is old.
And I'm not sure how this happened, but Joey Chestnut, the glizzy gladiator, the man who always seems to win the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest, is apparently going to be... at Ole Miss football's Grove Bowl games, which I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I guess he's going to be part of this. So, impressive. That's kind of the amusement we like in college sports. So to have the hot dog eating champ as part of that, Mizzou football seems to be doing well in the recruiting. I mean, apparently they managed to beat Georgia and Penn State for four-star QB Matt Zollers. That was one of those things that came up a little late last week, that it was an impressive kind of find. We mentioned Bear Alexander entering the transfer portal. Kind of a really horrible story out of Washington. This one caught my eye only because of the player. So Tybo Rogers, who was one of the backup running backs who played in the playoff games, he is now, he's been accused formally of two rapes during the season. It's going to come up with a whole bunch of questions on whether or not what the team knew about that. I know they were interviewing Ryan Grubb, who's obviously now he's with the Seattle Seahawks, and he just want to comment on what he knew at the time, because he had apparently been quoted as saying that Rogers was dealing with things off the field. without getting into specifics at one point. So it's going to be, that's an ugly situation. We'll see how that develops. It got my attention only because I was excited for him because he was from my hometown of Bakersfield, but it's just Bakersfield. Things always have a bad twist to them. That's my city. That's my hometown. And I was disappointed. So that one kind of caught my eye. Kurt Cignetti, who's of course the new coach of Indiana, previously at James Madison. This quote, he said, too many of his players came out like the old Indiana in practice on Tuesday. So I guess, you know, he doesn't miss the old Indiana, straight off the go Indiana, chop up the soul Indiana, set on his goals Indiana. Ski Mask, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to add a story to end it. It's less of a story, more of someone basically taking a running joke and actually going with it. With, you know, people say, I want to get into a sport. Do I start with episode one? It's like a running joke online. Well, someone in the subreddit is actually doing that. They are using the old Massey ratings, which are part of the BCS, and using their simulator. And they're simulating a 2014 playoff max, starting with the first season of college football. And when I say first season, he's starting in 1869. And he's updating with a post every day. He is currently at 1887. And it's interesting to watch the deep dive.
Is that what he's been doing? Because I've seen those posts, and I admit, I'm like, yeah. I don't have the time to keep up with this one.
Yeah, I'll drop the link, because he did, I don't know how to use Reddit super good, but he was able to create a landing page. So there's one page that, like, as he updates, it will update each week and will shoot out who's the champion. And you go to the page and see the story he made about it. I will link it in under the Twitter space.
But I appreciate that. That is amazing. I'm always like I mean, I remember there was a part of my life where I would have been able to do that. But I'm amazed at the commitment some of the folks have for some of these plans, some of these kinds of quirky ideas that they make the offseason kind of fun. Well, I think, you know what, we've been going for about an hour. This is a good spot to kind of wrap this up. I want to thank all of you for listening. This is RCFB Talk 188. We do these talks every Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern for about an hour in the off season. Sometimes a little shorter, sometimes a little longer, especially as we get to the regular season. But there's always stuff to talk about. It's an opportunity to listen to you, to have you join the conversation. I always enjoy hearing it. It's always fun to hear whatever y'all want to talk about. Basketball will hopefully be mostly in the rear view window. Not that I don't like talking about it. But we'll go ahead and wrap this up. Again, Bob Akairi is my name. College football's my game. Gosh, it's been a long night. If you're interested in the podcast, I also do the College Football Survivor Show with CBS Sports, Shahan Jayaraja. We do that for Advanced Sports Media. On behalf of all of us here at RCFB, thanks again. Now I'm going to hang up and listen.